Joining us in studio is Thomas Cornell. Among many other things, a lifetime service in peace and nonviolence social action, he was a co-editor of a book called A Penny a Copy back about 10 years ago, which I think detailed the history of the Catholic worker movement, of which he has been a part for many, many decades. And one of the things that he would be known for is that he organized the first protest against the Vietnam War back in August of 1963 in New York City, when I suspect 70% of the population of the United States had never heard of Vietnam. Welcome very much to KVMR, Thomas Cornell.
I'm very happy, and please call me Tom.
Okay.
That's my byline, Tom Cornell, and my son. Same name, so he calls himself T. Christopher.
I see.
It was July, by the way, July 16th, 1963, the first demonstration against the war in Vietnam, and there were two of us.
And this was, and you did it outside the, well, I'll let you explain it.
The residence, the apartment in which the representative from Saigon, the representative of the United Nations, lived. It was the only place in New York City where there was any kind of manifestation of the Republic of Vietnam, South Vietnam. They didn't have an airline or a consulate or anything like that. So Chris Cairns and I went on the 16th, a Monday, and we spent 2 hours picketing with a sign that said the Catholic worker protests against the United States military support of Diem dictatorship or tyranny. And the next day I went alone, and the next day Chris went alone. He, by the way, is a descendant, direct descendant of two signers of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush and Joseph Fletcher. We did this for 10 days, and on the 10th day, we had 250 people join us, because I was on the telephone to all the peace people, peace organizations, saying, the Catholic worker has an ongoing demonstration at the apartment where the Vietnamese representative to the UN lives. So you come and join us on the 10th day. I didn't tell him. It was only one or two of us at a time. I kind of pulled a fast one, and we had 250 people, and Lisa Howard came out to interview us. You may not remember her.
Do not.
But Lisa Howard was a very, very beautiful journalist activist who had been a movie star, tall and blonde, and she had taken part in the negotiations that solved the Cuban Missile Crisis. So she was a hot item in herself. On that basis, we got coast-to-coast coverage. So that was not only the first demonstration, but the first major coverage of any protest against the U.S. involvement in the Vietnamese Civil War.
I believe you also were, on several occasions, burned your draft card.
Yes, I did. How did you know that?
Oh, the miracles of the internet, sir.
It's not something.
And no, it was. I didn't get it from Homeland Security.
I'll tell you, no one paid any attention. I had a whole bunch of draft cards. You see, at that time, you had to have a registration card, but as well as that, you had to have a card indicating your current classification. I was first classified a high school student with a 2S. Then I had a 1A, then I had a 1AO, which meant that they would have drafted me into the Army, but as a nonviolent medic or something. I wouldn't accept even that. I had a 2S for college student, and it went back and forth like that until finally they gave me a 1O card when I was 26 years old and too old to do any kind of service, at which point I decided that Ammon Hennessy was right, maybe I shouldn't have registered at all, so I kind of unregistered. Symbolically to me, the burning of the draft card meant I'm not going to have anything more to do with you under any circumstances. So that was it. I burned one card and then kept the others, and it occurred to me that at appropriate events, like, you know, demonstrations, if things were lagging, I could take out a draft card and burn it. Then they made it illegal.
Of course.
In 1965, they made it illegal because the Vietnam War was heating up. There had been a demonstration on the 9th day of August, 1965, in which a large number of us, if my memory serves, about 1,500, marched upon the capital of the United States with the stated intention of seizing it for an assembly of unrepresented peoples. Staunton Lind and Dave Dellinger and Robert Moses were in the lead, and somebody threw a can of red paint at them and made a very, very dramatic photograph, which took the whole page of an edition of Life magazine. I think it was late, oh, gee, I can't remember, August of 1965. One page is full color of the marchers looking like they're spattered with blood, red paint. Mm-hmm. And the other side of the page was Chris Cairns burning his draft card at a demonstration at Whitehall, the induction center in Manhattan. Well, as I say, nobody paid much attention to these things until that day when the senators came down to the barber shop and opened up Life magazine and saw these photographs. And I forget who it was, one of the chief segs from Mississippi. "We can't let this sort of thing go on." Introduced a bill saying it was a specific felony to destroy that sacramental sign of the state, the draft card. And it was perfectly clear what they were doing. I mean, this bill sailed through the Senate and the House with something like 10 minutes discussion. And it was perfectly clear when Lyndon Johnson signed that legislation that it had only one purpose, and that purpose was an illegitimate one. It's not legitimate to pass laws and enforce laws that limit freedom of speech. And that's what we were doing. We were expressing a political opinion. So when I realized what had happened, I said in the Catholic Worker, I think September issue, 1965, this must be the time when we should start burning our draft cards. And so a group of us gathered together, and we had very carefully staged, beautifully staged event at Union Square, the Free Speech Center in New York. Five men burning their draft cards, flanked by Dorothy Day, who was then quite old, and H. A. Mustey, who was even older, and Mr. Pacifism of the 20th century. The two of them were mother and father to me. It was the first group act of resistance to the Vietnam draft. The police escorted us away. They did not arrest us. They were there to protect us because there were so many threats of violence. There were 250 cops around the buildings, the tops of the buildings at the north end of Union Square, cops on the ground.
Seems almost ironic, doesn't it?
Well, I didn't think so, really. They were doing a great job. They were helping. You know, they were doing what they're supposed to do. And we were called before the federal courts and charged with the violation, the crime, the felony. We had a wonderful legal defense team, top lawyers in the world, including Arya Nair, whose name, well, he's often, you know, a human rights lawyer, top grade international. Marvin Moses Karpatkin is a lead attorney, Thomas Emerson of Yale. We made a completely constitutional case. We were very polite, wore ties and all that sort of thing. Didn't want a jury trial. Chose to be tried by the bench. Gave the prosecution a motion picture film of the event. Conceded all the facts and made a totally constitutional argument, which argument was turned down at the appeal level. The Supreme Court refused to hear us. The same argument succeeded in the Texas flag-burning case. Acts of physical acts may be, in context, acts of speech in essence, and limiting them is against the First Amendment of the Constitution. These are protected acts.
We're speaking with Tom Cornell, a lifelong Catholic worker, joining us here in Nevada City. What brings you to Nevada City, by the way?
To see Harold Berliner, my dear old friend and a man without whom I could not have achieved my life's work.
How so?
Well,
without going into great detail, maybe.
You know, the defense of conscientious objectors and the furtherance of the cause of nonviolence, a theory and the practice, was, I was convinced, the will of God for me and my vocation. This is what I had to do in life, whatever else I had to do in life. And the resources to accomplish this are very few. You know, I've been in the civil rights movement and the poverty movement, and it's easy to raise money when it's a matter of justice between black and white or American Indians. It's easy to raise money to serve the very, very, very poor. Houses of hospitality, soup kitchens. I've been doing that, you know, decades. But the cause of conscientious objection, the cause of nonviolence, it's much, much harder for people to understand. The resources are very slender. But Harold and a family in Chicago and other individuals made it possible for us to organize an agency, a membership organization, part of the Fellowship of Reconciliation, called the Catholic Peace Fellowship, staffed, salaried at a level that made it possible for us to raise our families. I mean, made $65 a week. Had a boy to support and a wife. And, you know, I actually got up to what a Baptist minister, a country, you know, a backcountry Baptist minister would make.
Oh, boy, there was the lifestyle, huh?
Well, we managed, you know, and now we're back in the community of the Catholic worker, making $20 a week if we need it. But my wife and I are independently wealthy now. We don't need $20 a week. We have our Social Security.
Very good. What brought you to the Catholic worker movement?
I read Dorothy Day's autobiography, The Long Loneliness. It was published in 1952. I read it in the spring of 1953, and I was captivated by it and made my way down to the Catholic worker in the Bowery to meet Dorothy Day. And I did, and, well, she had me. The first words I heard her say just galvanized me. I'd heard them all before, the Bible quotes, but they were different. Somebody at a meeting was talking about security, how everybody should have the sense of security as to the basic necessities of life. We talk about the right to life a lot in the Catholic Church, you know.
I've heard that.
Yeah. Well, what does right to life mean? If you have a right to life, you must have the right to the means to life. And what are the means to life? The means to life in this day and age are education, vocational training, a job that's worth doing, and recompensed at a level appropriate to the decent support of a family. This has been Catholic social teaching since 1906, and we don't have it yet. Honest work, honest full-time work, deserves recompense at the level to raise a family in decency according to community standards.
What was your relationship with Dorothy Day? Because that, my guess is that you must have been.
It was very close. We had different backgrounds and different expectations, but and she didn't read me right. You know, I look kind of genteel, if you might say, so she assumed that I came from a background of privilege. And the exact opposite is the case. But she came to realize, you know, where I came from and where I was going or wanted to go. She made me editor of the Catholic Worker as my first assignment in the community. And I'm the only person she ever authorized to sign her name onto political statements without prior consultation.
I would say that would rank you pretty high.
Well, I had her confidence. I had her confidence, yeah. And I married one of the women in the community. I met her over a soup pot, quite literally. And we were married 7 months later. And Dorothy was very, very happy and generous. The meager resources that we had, you know, she gave me a going-away present that amounted to over a year's rent. Of course, rent was only $65 for an apartment that was heated and had hot water. You know, I wanted my wife to have heat and hot water. Nobody else in the community did.
Wow. Those were the days, I suspect. And then, I guess when you were growing up, what led you toward a path of nonviolence and social action? It must be.
Well, as I indicated, I did not grow up in privilege. It's hard to talk about these things because I don't want to, you know, seem to be asking for sympathy. But when I was 4 years old, my father became actively consumptive. It took him 10 years to die. He had made a very good living. He saved very little, and that was exhausted very quickly. We didn't have heat and hot water many a winter in Connecticut.
Now, I can tie the two together.
When I was attracted to a life of voluntary poverty, it wasn't out of any romanticism.
Yeah.
It wasn't, you know, I'll have this adventure of living without any money and living among the very, very poor, and won't that be great? And then I can get the hell out of it. I knew what it was, and I didn't want it. But I did want to join Dorothy in her mission to the very poor and to the working people. The working people. Now, when I was 16 and 17 years old, I was working 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, neither sitting nor standing, in an unorganized factory, coughing black.
Phew. That, would that have been right around the war?
No.
No?
I was born in 1934, so we're talking about the post-Korean War period.
Okay.
Just after the late Korean War, and just after that. I knew I could escape this life, but who were these women and these guys? It was mostly women in this factory. It was a fabrics factory, as I say, unorganized, and the workers were treated very, very badly. And I knew I could get out of there. But leaving those people behind, I couldn't turn my back on them. It would be, to me, a sin. That I had to put something of my life's energy into the defense of working people, doing an honest job, trying to make a living, organizing in their own behalf for better working conditions, for better salaries. This is a work of the Holy Spirit. I firmly believe that. Dorothy Day taught that. Cardinal O'Connor taught that. It's been the teaching of the Catholic Church since 1893.
And, of course, the Catholic worker movement continues into today. In fact, I'm sure a lot of it with its roots in what some of the stuff that you were doing. I know in particular it has been a place of refuge for immigrants.
Yeah.
Face arrest sometimes with sanctuary houses.
Yeah.
Thinking of the big arrest in Iowa, in Postville, Iowa, not that long ago.
Yeah. Yeah.
A farm town where I had friends who grew up in that town and have now seen that town change.
We just sent them $500.
And speaking of Iowa, not that long ago, a couple of Catholic workers attempted a citizen's arrest of some guy named Karl Rove.
when he was speaking
at an more or less unannounced on a country club reception. Of course, it would be at a country club in Des Moines.
Great, wonderful.
And this spirit, this tradition does continue.
Resistance, active, nonviolence is not non-action. Nonviolence is active resistance, but It's without any kind of expectation of victory and defeat or humiliation of the enemy, nothing like that. It's toward reconciliation and healing and the establishment of justice.
And I guess, since we're talking about the present, how do you see what the roots that you folks set in the anti-war movement and the anti-poverty movement from back in the 50s
started in the 30s, yeah, we're 75 years old this year. What do I see now? Well, it's very, very discouraging and very, very frightening. Now, we don't get into electoral politics, and I can't say anything on behalf of the Catholic worker in this regard. But I can say for myself that I find the prospects of a McCain victory absolutely terrifying for the cause of poor people, for the cause of the middle class, for the cause of peace, for the cause of our country. Now, some of my fellow workers get a little upset when they hear me saying this. But I am a firm and strong patriot. I love this country. It's a land where my fathers died, going back to 1627. Well, actually, the first one that died here died in 1673, hanged by the neck, convicted of first-degree murder.
I see.
His name was Tom Cornell Jr.
There was a congressman named Tom, or
yes,
Tom
there was.
Cornell.
There
see what
was.
Happens when you go to Google?
I think he was Wisconsin. I never knew the man. It's a large family.
Okay.
All over the, there's in Germany and in England, and mostly here.
No relationships in your to either Cornell University or Cornell College? Or
yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. We're all descended from the couple that settled in 1627. Tom Cornell, born 1595 in Essex, and Rebecca Rebecca. Oh my goodness, how can I forget Grandma's name? She's the one who died, and she died in a fire. And her brother came to the inquest and said, "My sister came to me in a dream and said Tommy done it." On that evidence, they hanged Tom Cornell Jr. Those were the days. America.
You might have had a chance at the Supreme Court with that one. Maybe.
Well, you know, we do have a history in our country of political culture that's offered a lot to the rest of the world. But now we've become a disgrace on the world stage with this illegal war, with a leadership that really deserves citizens' arrest. They deserve to be taken to The Hague and put on trial before an international court, and to see that we might have more of the same, led by wing nuts. This is a terrifying thing for anyone who really loves this country.
And we're living in it.
And, of course, the peace movement now, well, you know, if we had a draft, there would be considerably, vivacious demonstrations at the University of Kansas. The reddest of states would have student rebellion if we had a draft. Now, if a nation wants to go to war and its people don't support it to the point of offering to serve, in a democratic society, there's something very wrong.
And not only that, in the people during this particular war have never been asked to sacrifice, exception, of course, being the parents and families of the soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
There's never been a war tax, good heavens. That would go against the Republican.
It's the first time
branding.
In history we've had a war and a reduction of taxes. Reduction for the guess who?
We'll leave that. Well, someone will figure that one out. I think. You were talking earlier on about civil liberties and about some of the court cases in which you were involved.
Yeah.
When you look at the current Supreme Court and the current administration and what has happened to civil liberties Your thoughts?
Very frightening. Very frightening. We don't address these issues at the Catholic Worker in our paper, as I say, and I can't speak for the Worker, for the movement, for the paper, but I find it very embarrassing and frightening, the Supreme Court appointments. The first time we have a Catholic majority on the Supreme Court, and all I can say is, oy vey.
It really is. It's a Catholic majority now?
Yeah.
Oh. Wow.
Oy vey.
Yeah. That's, I had never realized that, but you're right. Counting them up in my head right now.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, I'm guessing that, well, obviously, those, the majority of those Catholic judges were part of the Catholic Church that was probably not influenced in any way, shape, and or form by the Catholic Worker side.
I don't think one of them subscribes to the Catholic Worker, and the subscription rate is very, very generous. It's 25 cents a year, and we never take anybody off the mailing list.
In fact, that just brings me back to, of course, I haven't seen the book, but just was reading a little bit about it. I believe it's called A Penny a Day.
A Penny a Copy.
Penny a Copy.
Yeah, because we sell the paper at a penny, a nominal fee. But Dorothy Day always said, people don't really value something if they don't pay for it, so let them pay a penny.
And you wrote, this was sort of a compendium.
This is actually an anthology
right.
of writings in the Catholic Worker between the foundation year, the founding year, 1933, and 10 years ago, about 10 years ago it came out. I'm not quite sure. Actually, it was the second edition. The first edition came out in 68, and it was such a joy. I was in prison at the time.
Tell us about that.
It's very dull. That's the worst part about it. The boredom is what kills you.
Mm-hmm.
I had burned my draft card in the first act of group resistance to the Vietnam draft with four other young men at a very dignified, well-organized demonstration at the north end of Union Square in New York City, the free speech section. Dorothy Day came out to speak for us. It was, by the way, the only time she ever spoke out of doors. And A.J. Musty, the great A.J. Musty, was also with us. A.J.'s name may not be known to very many of your listeners, but he was Mr. Pacifism of the 20th century. He was the guy behind Martin Luther King. The guy behind Martin King was Bayard Rustin, and A.J. was in back of Bayard. Mm. A.J. had trained Victor and Walter Reuther. 1937 Flint Strike, made famous by Michael Moore.
Right.
Uh-huh. And
another Catholic.
By the way, yes, he is. And guess who paid the bills for the civil rights movement for the 63 March? You bet. It was the labor movement. It was Walter and Victor Reuther behind much of it. And so A.J. was a central figure linking the peace movement, the civil rights movement, the labor movement, religious radicals, trade unionists, old left, the old Trotskyists, everybody. Everybody trusted him. And he spoke for us. It was a wonderful, dignified demonstration. And we were protected by 250 New York City policemen who were ringed around the square and the tops of the buildings because there were threats of violence. And they pulled it off very nicely. It had massive publicity, front page of every newspaper in the country. So I say it was the very first demonstration of a group character against the Vietnam draft. And, of course, it was replicated later on all over the country. But at least we were happy to set the example, that it could be done and it should be done. We were sentenced to only 6 months. We expected 2 or 3 years. But our judge, Thomas Francis Ava Murphy, was very well disposed to us because we didn't ask for a jury trial. We made a totally constitutional case. We conceded the prosecution's case, gave them a motion picture film of the entire event. So there wasn't any question about the facts. Mm-hmm. The question was this act an act of free speech that could not be suppressed without violating the First Amendment to the Constitution? Well, Judge Murphy really had to find us guilty or we wouldn't be able to appeal. And that's what we wanted to do.
So that's what happened in that one.
We wanted to be convicted. And the judge, I think he understood that. So he gave us a very lenient sentence of only 6 months, and he was singled out for negative criticism by the Justice Department, the only federal judge that year, for his leniency in the case of United States of America versus Tom Cornell et al. You know, when you get an indictment that says the United States of America versus, and then they name you, it's really a startling thing to see.
But I think something you can be proud of here some 40 years
well,
later.
Well, I got a pardon from Jimmy Carter on the first day he was in office. He pardoned everyone.
On the first day?
He pardoned everyone who had been convicted of a nonviolent offense against the Selective Service Act of 1940.
And I don't recall that. And yet
it was controversial at the time. it was great fun. I, you know, being an anarchist and all of that, I do have to say that during the Carter administration, we could at least talk to people in Washington. I could go to the State Department and spend a half a day, not 10 minutes. I could go to Andy Young. I'd worked with him in Selma, Alabama, in 65, the Great March. Going to jail there, too. Mm-hmm. I could call Andy and get things done. Never since. Never since.
Not even the Clinton administration?
No.
Interesting.
No.
Speaking with Tom Cornell, a lifelong Catholic worker, activist, and as we were finding out, has a lengthy arrest record here, sir. How many times were you arrested?
About 14. The last time was a year ago.
Just a year ago, and that was?
At the United Nations, where I used to be an honored guest. Instead, they hauled me away and put me... Actually, I was in a jail cell. It was great fun for 6 hours with Dan Berrigan and Art Wasco and six of us in all. And it was nice to spend some time in that atmosphere with those guys. We were dismissed without, what do they call it, on our own recognizance with contemplation of dismissal, all that sort of thing. The oldest person in our arrest group was a 92-year-old Quaker woman who was a very dear friend, Frances Crow of Northampton, Massachusetts.
Mm. So you've got... A lot of these people go way back with.
Yeah.
You mentioned the Berrigans who were.
Yeah. I took Phil Berrigan to his first peace demonstration.
Taught him the ropes, sort of.
He baptized my daughter. We're still in touch with Dan.
Now, I guess just speaking some of the seminal figures, I guess, of that era. That we still have around today. What about Pete Seeger? You live near him.
He lives across the river in Beacon.
Across the river, okay.
The Hudson
Safe
River.
Safe distance, huh?
Well, I first met him in the mid-50s at the home of some labor activists who were celebrating a great victory. They attempted to adopt a child, and the right-wingers at that time, during the McCarthy period, made it almost impossible for them, although they... You know, lovely middle-class kind of family just happened to be involved in the labor movement, so they were smeared as leftists, communists, God, so our barriers were thrown up.
And this is about
adoption. They succeeded, and Pete came to the celebration, and he taught us the mambo. And I could never make it, even as a young guy. But then we kept on bumping into each other at various times and places. One time, they were burning American flags at demonstrations. Now, I don't like that sort of thing. It's very offensive. Norman Thomas, the great leader of the Socialist Party, who had run for president something like half a dozen times, used to say, "Don't burn the flag, boys. Launder it." So he took a big American flag down to City Hall Park and laundered it. And Pete came to sing for us. And he was so funny. It was great fun. Another time I met him was at Mike Gold's funeral. Mike Gold was the editor of the Daily Worker for many years. He wrote a book that's still in print, Jews Without Money. It's a really wonderful memoir of growing up on the Lower East Side of New York in the Jewish community there in poverty. And Mike Gold was an object of Dorothy Day's affections. Bill Buckley said that Dorothy Day was just too much for even Mike Gold to handle. Too much of a leftist. But Dorothy spoke at Mike's funeral.
Are you speaking of Bill Buckley, the conservative columnist?
Oh, yes, yes.
Oh, okay. Yes. So he was... anyway.
So we got into conversation with Pete after the service, and he says, "I've been trying to find your farm over in Tivoli." We had a big piece of land in Tivoli near the... north of the Franklin Roosevelt estate. He says, "I follow the directions, I get down by the river, and then I turn right, and there's this gully. So I turn back." And Dorothy said, "That's our road. It's a gully." So
you found the gully, you found the place.
I've been inviting him to come over to our place, our new place, which is smaller, only 50 acres, most of it wetlands, only 2 acres cultivated. But he's getting old, and he doesn't do too much traveling anymore. He's a wonderful man. I mean, he's real true blue. He's never gone sour and never sold out.
Just a few months ago, he was part of a medical benefit for our very own Utah Phillips here back in April, along with Dar Williams. Right in your neighborhood there. And, of course, I think maybe in Rosendale. Okay, I think the Rosendale Cafe, and they ended up moving it someplace else because so many people obviously wanted to come. I bring up Utah Phillips. Yeah. You said you've
run... I met him only once.
Okay.
In the men's room at a camping site west of Des Moines, Iowa. We had a Catholic worker gathering last year, and he came out, and we reminisced about Ammon Hennessy. He lived with Ammon for some time and had loads of funny stories about Ammon. And loads of really revelatory stories, too. We had a very good time. And I wished he'd been able to come out to our place. I invited him, but his health was failing.
Right. Someone we miss very much here.
I'm sure you do.
Among the other things, he and... his wife and true love, Joanna Robinson, helped begin a thing called the Hospitality House here.
We went to visit it yesterday. Was it yesterday?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah,
and which
great
doesn't
place.
Sound all that different from something called the House of Hospitality.
We have houses of hospitality. Each one of them is completely autonomous and run according to whatever model they want to have. In New York, ours are very unprofessional, shall we say. Whereas I get the feeling that there's greater structure and control at the house here, which is just fine because you have to look at your resources, look at your needs, and then do what you got to do. But we have very few rules. We take people in, and once we make a commitment to them, it's from there on out, you know. Most of the people who come to us are at the end of their ropes. There's no, you know, if there's any rehabilitation that's possible, we try to facilitate that. We'll bring them to agencies. We'll call other people in. But one fella came to us. His mother brought him. He was 19. And she said, "My boy, he doesn't have it all together up here, you know, but he's a good boy. He won't cause you no trouble. And I'll come back for him on Monday." She left no papers, no identification. That was 1937. Mm. He just died at the age of 84.
Wow. Still there.
Well, he's buried with us.
Wow.
He had a job. He raked the leaves in the autumn, and in the winter, he cut paths in the snow. But they weren't according to any pattern except in his head, so we called them Pathways to Utopia. But he was well-loved, and he had a life. Now, if we'd put him in a car and drove him to an emergency room in a hospital and just drove away, the state of New York would have had to take responsibility for him. They would have spent $30,000 a year to keep him in a bed with, you know, the rest. Mm-hmm. He wouldn't have had a life. He wouldn't have had dogs. He wouldn't have had kids. He wouldn't have had babies around him. He wouldn't have had the sense of doing anything to contribute to the movement or the house, the work. Work, you need work for your own dignity. If you don't, there's something wrong with you. And we got them, too.
Yeah. Well, you know, just thinking.
But you know, he had a good life, and it costs us about $3,000 a year to maintain a person. Not 30. In dignity, with good food, homegrown, organic.
Well, you call it hospitality.
Yeah. We live as a family. It's an extended family. And like any family, we have problems. You know, there's always the dotty aunt and the drunken uncle and the, the rebellious kid.
As you look back again, I guess, over these years, what other impressions do you get as years have gone on about the commitment that you made back as a youth, and extending now into your elder
years? Golden
years,
shall we say, yes. Or shall we say twilight years?
You would be called what Utah would say, we learn from our elders.
We have very few. I have few elders, yes. Most of my friends are dead. Mm-hmm. It's been wonderful. It's been really wonderful. I haven't made a lot of money, but I've had a lot of fun. I've been all over the world. I've met the most extraordinary people, most extraordinary friendships. I've been able to help people, humble and in high places. I helped the Pope one time. It's a long story. I can't go into it.
Okay.
But I saved him an embarrassment.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And Paul the VI. I can see that with the help of a little, you know, with a little help from our friends, we have made a significant difference. We push things ahead. And I can die very happy.
Mm. You know, I thought maybe we might just close. This is actually a quote from Utah Phillips. And just see what your reaction is to it. And he says, too many good people are doing too many good things for me to afford the luxury of being pessimistic.
I'm glad he could say that. The only thing that keeps me from sheer pessimism is religious faith, frankly. But, you know, we lived through the McCarthy period. We've lived through others. We lived through the Vietnam period. We're going to have to make it through this. We have to. And somehow, if enough good people keep on doing enough good things, we'll leave an example for our kids. We're not leaving an America for our kids, the one that we inherited. That's changed. We got to bring it back. But that's not for us to do. That's for the kids to do. And we've left them an example. And we've made our own mistakes, certainly. But the young people, I am very much impressed with the young people that I meet as I travel the country, speaking at colleges, community colleges, high schools, churches, community groups. Kids got their hearts in the right place. What we need is better access information, and that's why I'm glad to be here at this radio station. The mass media have failed us miserably, more than miserably, criminally. The monopolization of the ownership of the sources of information has been disastrous for American democracy. But here, every voice is welcome at these microphones. I understand. Every voice.
And I guess we're dealing with a mass media that starts talking about lipstick and some of the other side issues time.
No significance whatever. Just diverting people's attention from the problems that beset us, which strike us to the very heart. Our very survival. The survival of the middle class in this country. The survival of this country as a democracy.
You know, and I see headlines from the week that in which we're talking right now I don't see headlines. I just sort of start gleaning information that I believe there were 30,000 homes in Cuba destroyed this week. My guess is that the average American has no idea of that. Haiti has been hit by, I believe, 4 hurricanes in the past month or so. Devastation there, which they didn't start off on a very high note to begin with, and this just knocks them down. Mm-hmm. And yet, it is organizations like the Catholic Workers and other humanitarian people that make a difference to those people. Mm-hmm. Do you think?
Yeah. Only more people went down.
And of course, we're also dealing in an era where it seems like, we're told this is an endless war that we're in right now. We're
how do you know
this.
When you've won?
Exactly. Is this something that seems unparalleled to you from
my own experience, certainly. I've been to Iraq. I was there before the invasion. I was there after. I long to go back. I think I was the second last person from the Iraqi peace teams to be in Baghdad. There's no one gone back since because it's too dangerous even now. We have people in the north, in Kirkuk, in the Kurdish regions. But, you get to know these people, and it's heartrending. I pray every day, twice a day, for my friends there. And I find myself, choking up when I think about these kids and their possibilities. What there was before we got involved and what there is now. That oil underneath their sand, they can see considered to belong to all of them. That oil paid for the education of any kid who could get as far as the system there or here or any place else would allow him. I had a friend who got a college degree in engineering in Baghdad. He got accepted at UCLA. The government sent him over, paid his airfare, paid his tuition, bought his books, gave him a stipend to live on. He got himself a master's degree and returned and did very, very well as an entrepreneur. But the young people that I know there now do not have that opportunity. The oil is not going to pay for their education. It's not going to pay for their health care. If you get sick, if you need medications, you go into a hospital. By the way, the best hospital I've ever seen in my life is in the Karada section of Baghdad, St. Raphael's Hospital, and run by Dominican nuns from France. It's like a luxury hotel. But anybody off the street can go there, and basic care will be provided. Everything that's needed will be provided in the old days, pre-invasion, at government expense. If you want something extra, you want to fly in a surgeon from London, okay, you want to pay for it, you can do it. But basic care is there for everybody, paid for by the common resource of oil. I wonder what it's going to be like when they finally make the deal. The deal is not going to support the educational and health needs of these shoeshine boys and these peddlers and these waiters and clerks, these little girls in the school. It breaks my heart. It really does. I want to go back so bad and find my friends.
We've been speaking with We've been speaking with Tom Cornell, a lifelong Catholic worker visiting Nevada City, and we appreciate your time here very much. Any final thoughts as we close this out?
Well, don't go sour, don't sell out.
Sounds good to me. Thanks very much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And you've been listening to a conversation with Tom Cornell, a Catholic worker, editor, and activist for many decades, who was visiting his good friend Harold Berliner here in Nevada City.